If you take a walk around the Nieuwmarkt in the centre of Amsterdam and look very carefully, you might be able to catch glimpses of the textile industry that once bloomed there from the 16th century up until the Second World War. The Staalstraat street, for example, which many assume has something to do with steel, was in fact named this way because of the Staalhof and the Staalmeesters, sampling officials who worked there. These officials used textile samples, stalen in Dutch, to inspect and grade the quality of the textiles on offer. Other examples are the Ververstraat, the Dyer's Street, and the Raamgracht, frame canal, which refers to the frames on which textiles were stretched after they'd been washed and dyed. Artist Helene van Deur investigated this rich history through art. In her work Uit het Stof Gehaald, she explored 32 professions that once lay at the heart of the textile industry in Amsterdam. The ragsorter, or lompensorteerder in Dutch, sorted worn pieces of cloth, such as wool or linen, for reuse, like making of paper. The blauwverver, or blue dyer, used indigo to dye and re-dye textiles. Their recipes were kept highly secret. When I ask Helene about what drew her to study the crafts on the Nieuwmarkt, she responds emotionally. I have boundless respect for the people that used to work here. I was drawn to these people because they had terribly difficult lives. I sometimes think we should be happy that all these crafts have disappeared. The dyers, for example, stood in filthy pools of muck and urine up to their ankles to get the dye onto the textiles. Yet, at the same time, there is enormous beauty in this craftsmanship. Why do I get so emotional about this? Maybe because crafts are so underappreciated, especially in the arts. And that despite the fact that historically arts and crafts have always been so closely intertwined. Helene explains that these crafts were not carried out in isolation, but were codependent on one another. Bigger operations were often subdivided out into separate tasks. Some people only unpicked thread or removed pilling from textiles. She talks about how various crafts and techniques were brought in by migrant groups, and thus how this industry became a place where artisanal traditions intermingled. Helene is acutely aware of the differing social statuses of and within these professions, and speaks reverently of the role of the Jewish community in the textile street trade. She explains how Jews were excluded from joining the guilds, and thus often had to restrict themselves to trading second-hand goods on the market. Rag sorting, for example, was a classically Jewish profession. Rag sorters would collect and sort discarded rags and worn-out clothing, sometimes for reuse, but most often to be broken down into a pulp for making paper. Having seen the works of Helene, it's impossible to ignore the magnitude and diversity of the various professions and crafts that made up this once thriving textile industry. I ask her what she thinks would need to happen for a technique like plant dyeing to be brought back to life, in more than just an experimental way. She recalls a time she visited the Stedelijk Museum with a friend, a professor of agriculture. In this museum, there were some beautiful examples of dyeing textiles, and I was very lyrical about them. My friend is quite skeptical about such possibilities. She responded to my lyricism in a very rational way. "You don't think that we could do this at a bigger scale," she said. "The current reality is that if you want a piece of clothing that looks good and will last a long time, it will cost thousands of euros. Well, perhaps the elite will happily spend that money, and perhaps the Rue de Montagne will gladly try it. But the rest of the public will go to Zara or H&M and buy something that looks like it for a tenner. So, our visit to the museum put me back on earth. But I nevertheless think that these old, extinct crafts need to be described well." Helene's anecdote is a relevant one. It makes me think. There seems to be a tension between experimentation with natural dyes and the existing norms and expectations regarding clothing. Whenever the word scale is mentioned in the clothing industry, we tend to think of large corporations like Zara and H&M. These companies have, regardless of intention, changed what we expect of clothing. One example of this is repair. In the Netherlands, it was once very normal to repair clothing and wear repaired clothing. But such companies have made garments so cheap that it's not worth people's time to repair them. You might as well buy a replacement. And so, over time, our repair practices have eroded, which in turn has made it normal to produce and buy unmendable clothing. We're not surprised if we see such irreparable clothing on the shelves now. The same goes for the way colour has disconnected from its sources and become something we simply expect to have a broad choice in. As Helene demonstrates with her work Blauwfärber, the colour of a textile in the 16th century in Amsterdam used to bear significance by virtue of how difficult it was to make. Recipes were kept under lock and key. Some colours were much more valuable than others. This also meant that the elite were able to flaunt their wealth by wearing certain coloured clothes. Nowadays, since the advent of synthetic dyes, the existence of such expensive colours has faded. But with this fading has also come the expectation that clothing should be available in almost any colour imaginable, and we can question whether that's a desirable norm. In the same way such corporations have, through their production lines, changed the meaning of colour, they've also shaped our understanding of what it means to scale in the textile industry. So, if we want to talk about how techniques like plant dyeing might be scaled up, we must take care to examine what we mean by that word. Which scaling practices are implied? Which expectations and norms around clothing are taken for granted and thus reinforced? For large corporations that need to protect their market share, it makes sense to only stimulate and invest in dyeing processes that have the potential to scale up to the extent that they might replace existing processes. But if our idea of scaling up only allows us to look for one optimal way of doing things, we risk ignoring a wealth and diversity of dyeing practices. Scaling in this way would never allow for multiple dyeing techniques to exist at once. Helene ends her anecdote by insisting that old crafts must be described and documented well. For a project like Local Colour, such documentation and artistic engagement with history could not be more valuable. Historical accounts of textile industries allow us to make comparisons with the way things are today. What was good, what was bad, and how should we approach the future?